Today's date is November the 6th, 2009. My name is Jonathan Gerland, and I'm with Mr. Jim Ligon. We're at the History Center today in Diboll, and we're going to do an oral history. Jim, if you would, let's just begin maybe by telling me when and where you were born.
Well, John, I was born in Diboll, February 23rd, 1929. Just during the Depression. And, well, growing up here, I, of course, all that time was just spent, you know, in this little local town. I hadn't gone any place else for a long time. It was like going someplace interesting when we went to Lufkin. That was a big city.
Who were your parents?
Jim Ligon. I'm a junior.
Junior, okay.
Yeah, Jim Ligon and Estella. Ligon, she was a, she, her maiden name's a Patton.
Patton,
P-A-T-T-O-N.
Okay. Where were they from originally?
Well, my mother was from Houston County, Crockett, or really Kennard.
Kennard, okay.
Kennard and Tadmore, it's a little neighborhood area over there that's pretty close together, Ratcliffe. And Daddy was from Grimes County, Anderson, I think that's Anderson County, Anderson, Texas, and Grimes County. That was where he was born.
Okay.
So, of course, he went around several different places, you know, close around the areas I grew up. And that was, you know, like... When I remember very well when we had an assignment from school. This was very interesting that the teachers had us to bring that information to school to tell where our parents was born. And I was on my way to school that day to give the answer, and I said, oh, I had to ask my mother and them where they were born. So I had to go back and ask them, and I asked my mother, and she said, I was born in Houston County. And Ratcliffe, or Kennard, I think it was Kennard. And I, on my way out, I asked Dad, and he said, well, I was born in Anderson, Texas, Grimes County. So and I took that, I didn't, that yeah, so that's how I found it out.
Now, you were telling me before about your father and that he was at Alceda.
Yeah.
The Southern Pine Lumber Company logging camp for a while.
Yes.
What do you know about that?
Well, I was much too young to really remember anything that was going on there.
That was what, before you were born, right?
Yeah, it was before I was born.
Right.
I really don't know what year that what picture was taken.
And you're referring to a photograph,
photograph
that you gave us the other day.
Right. But our dad did tell me a little bit about it even as a kid, you know, that he had this, he barbecued, and he was a cook.
Okay.
So he followed these camps around in various places where they were cutting timber and what have you, and he provided them meals and what have you to take care.
And from the photograph, it looked like he had a crew of four or five other people.
He did have a crew. He had a crew. And on that picture, you will notice the man standing next to him on the right-hand side. My mother would tell me a lot about him. His name was Mr. Horn.
And that was on your father's left?
Right.
To your father's left?
Well, to my father's left.
Yes.
And she said that he was my dad's best friend. And apparently he must have been important to Daddy probably in his work or whatever, but I never knew him.
Never knew him. What was your father doing that you can remember when you were a child, say school age, young school age? Where did your father work then?
Well, he never worked for anyone but himself.
Okay.
See, when he when in Diboll, he leased the land that we lived on for 100 years.
Okay, he leased the land.
For 100 years, right. So Daddy was just, he kept his own business just, instead of working for the lumber yard and mill and everything. Of course, he knew all the people and all that. Everybody still patronized him. Come and buy the barbecue every weekend. So he built this cafe called the Froggy Bottom Cafe. It was located on the west side of Diboll going toward the lake, the Ryan's Lake, you might say. Very edge of the woods on this side, just across from the graveyard that's existing there right now. And that's where he continued to work for himself at that location until I just grew, until I was really... Oh, until he died, really.
Now, did y'all live next to the restaurant?
We lived right there on the same property.
Same property.
Well, he built a house right across from the house that we were living in before I was born in this house behind that. Froggy Bottom hadn't been built then. But after I was born in 1929, sometime after then, he built this house first. And that's where the family lived. And he had leased all this land, so he built Froggy Bottom Cafe. So that was really an amazing thing, because as a kid, I can remember a lot of activities that went in there, like boxing. He had this guy, he was a pretty well-known boxer. My brother knew him pretty well, but he kind of traveled around, but he had a few fights. He never was champion. But he came through here one time, and he was going to fight anybody who could stay in the ring with him for one round. He was going to give him $10. And we had one guy, he's one of the guys that worked for Southern Pine Lumber Company. And can't think of his name. Gosh, I can't right now, but I'll probably think of it later.
Okay.
But anyway, he was going to fight him, and man, everybody was all up in the air going to see his fight tonight. And when he got off from work at Southern Bond, he kind of turned to look for him, and he couldn't find the guy no place. So he didn't show up for the fight.
The outside boxer.
Outside boxer. Well, he was ready.
Oh, he was ready. The guy from Southern Pine didn't show
right.
up.
Right. I remember very well. He had this deal. He set up this boxing ring inside of the cafe. It's a big cafe there. And they were getting ready, and people was coming over. I can't think of his name right now, but maybe it'll come to me. But anyway, he didn't show up.
Did you fight him then?
Well,
did anybody step up?
Nobody stepped up because everybody was anticipating
to watch.
They were going to watch it. They were going to watch the fight, and he just didn't show. So this guy, I can remember him, the real fighter. I can remember him very well because he was sparring around in the ring a lot, you know, that they had fixed in the cafe, and he was in that shadow boxing and everything. We thought that was really fantastic. And of course, maybe that was what scared him away, but he didn't show up. And Daddy had a lot of, I remember it being the type of place that most of the young people didn't hang out there. It was mostly for grown-ups, and of course you could come, but it wasn't really a hangout for just young people, you know, like a canteen or whatever. But at any rate, he had this friend of Dad, was named Prayer Davis, or Roosevelt Davis, I think his name might have been. But anyway, he worked for the company too. But he was a guy that booked activities for Daddy's Cafe, because he was big enough to have little things going on.
So it was kind of like a nightclub.
It really was. Somewhat like a nightclub, but it was like a little civic center too. You know,
okay.
you could have little functions in there.
Right.
So in addition to having the jukebox in there and the dancing and all that kind of stuff, he could have the fights, the boxes, and anything else that went on. That was the two main things that he had that I remember. But except the one other thing, when Prayer Davis booked...
Spell that first name?
David. P-R-A-Y-E-R. I think his name is on that list. Prayer Davis. I think Roosevelt Davis, I think, is his real name.
Okay, I'm sorry.
I think
Go
Prayer
ahead.
Was one of his nicknames, I think. But anyway, he found out that Count Basie was coming through Diboll. He had been probably to Shreveport or somewhere and going to Houston. And Diboll was in between. And he contacted him to stop over and would he play at Diboll once that Saturday night. And sure enough, he did.
Wow, Count Basie.
You wouldn't believe Count Basie played in my daddy's cafe. And I remember that we couldn't go in as kids, you know, too much, even though I lived there.
Yeah, so I was going to ask you if you worked there or anything.
Oh, I would help Dad all the time in the cafe.
Even as a small child?
As a small child, right. Uh-huh. But, you know, just to be going there, just to sit around, none of the kids hardly ever came. They come in and buy a soda or something like that.
Were they just not allowed to? Or just,
well, it was
just a choice? Or?
I wouldn't say it wasn't allowed. They shouldn't be there because there was a lot of activities going on that involved grown people. Yeah. And, you know,
kids didn't have any drinking?
No, it wasn't drinking. It was just... they played a lot of dominoes. Okay. He had card tables, and you know, these are grown-ups' games, and you know, just didn't want kids around, I guess. And it was mostly done at night anyway, not usually during the day. So that kind of cut us out of it. But when,
did they have any live music other than on a regular basis, or was it?
No, this was the only time that we had a live band or anything. Then that was when Count Basie
came through.
And I remember what made me remember it. I really didn't know who Count Basie was at the time, but this lady that was singing with his band. I remember my mother let me come into the kitchen part, and I could see outside, and we were like behind the band because we had this counter in the front, and the band was right in front of the counter, and they had all that room out there for dancing. But behind here was the kitchen part, so I was back there looking at the dance. So she let me come in for a little while, my sister, and this woman who was singing had long hair, and it hung down about her waist on the back.
And she was a black woman?
Yeah, uh-huh. And so she was singing this song, and she went backwards like this, how you can lean back all the way. And how she stood up to do that, I don't know, but she leaned back until her hair touched the ground, the floor. And then she raised back up, you know, and continued on with whatever was going on. You know, that was the thing that stuck in my mind more. It was amazing.
The woman with the long hair that touched the ground.
Right. It's such an amazing thing that I don't remember anything else. I think my mother told me to go back in the house or whatever. Stayed in there for a while. But it was interesting. You know, that was just some of the things. Dad had a lot of things going for him. You know, he was a blacksmith, too. He could build wagon wheels. I mean, from scratch. I mean, the spokes, the hub, and all of those things. And that's where I found out how they put that iron over the wheels when they get that wood and stuff around it.
Mm-hmm.
And he had this rim, which is an iron rim. He built this wheel just so it was just a little bit larger than the rim. He measured and got that so perfect, I'll never know. But anyway, he heated the rim in a fire. So this makes the metal expand.
Right.
So then he dug this trench in the ground, and they poured water in it to about so deep, just kind of, and then they run a rod through the wheel when they got ready to put the rim onto the wheel. Well, the rim had expanded, and they laid it on the ground, and they had to tap it around till it went right on. You could see the smoke coming from around the rim. Then they immediately put it into this shaft through this rod, and then they spin the wheel so it could hurry up and cool off. And that made it jam tight on the deal. And if you'd ever noticed that, it must be the way they've always done it, because you never see any nails or rivets or anything in the rim. It's just tight to the wood. And that's how the old people, it's got to be the only way they did it.
Yes, I think so. They even did that on the locomotives, on the steam engines. They had the steel wheel, but then they called them tires. But it was that outer band, the flange part.
Yeah.
And they would do the same thing. They heat it up to expand it, push it on, and then cool it.
That's how Dad did it.
But your father did that for wagon wheels, huh?
Yeah,
on
wagon
wood. On wood spoke.
On wood spoke.
Wheels with the metal. Mm-hmm. Bands around them for the...
Yes, I used to watch him do it. He would take, instead of sandpaper, I remember very well, he'd take broken Coke bottle glasses, and that's what he would use to finish it.
Oh.
With. And get just as smooth as this, because of scraping it.
Mm-hmm.
It would just curl up. It takes a little while to do that, and he did every spoke, and they all looked alike.
Now, did you? What about your siblings? How many brothers and sisters did you have?
Well, it was seven of us. My mother had 11 altogether, but seven of us survived.
Okay.
And the other four, it came, you know, before I'm the baby of the family, so I didn't really get to know them.
Okay.
But she had seven of us, and all seven of us survived up until. My oldest brother from about 1970.
So some of your brothers and sisters had already left home by the time you were born, or
Well, they hadn't really left here because all of my sisters and brothers was always around close.
Okay, but I mean, they didn't live in the house.
Oh, no. My oldest brother was married.
They were married. Okay.
Right. And, of course, then my other brother was married, and my other brother got married. Well, they all got married, you know, I think before I finished high school.
Okay.
And then
because I was just going to ask you if you had memories of your older brothers maybe helping your father with the blacksmith business or the cafe.
Oh yes,
like
they were here, and many times they would help Dad do work around there. And I wasn't quite big enough to do some of the things they were doing. I remember them cutting wood for the heaters. And what they had these cross-cut saws and stuff, they cut wood, split it, and stack it, and cord it all up, you know, for the winter and stuff like that. And they would help him around in the cafe at times, but the only work I did was sweeping up, keeping it in the floor clean after something went on. I'd clean it up and clean the yard up. That was basically my job.
Okay. What were your brothers and sisters' names?
Johnny Jones was these are all my half-brothers and sisters.
Okay.
Johnny Jones was my oldest brother, then Oscar Jones and Vester Jones, then Della Jones, my sister, and Joy Mae Smith, you might know her. Okay. Well, they all are very good friends of the family. They were good friends of Ellen. My sister worked for Ellen. Temple.
Temple, okay.
Yeah, long time, and Buddy.
Okay.
They were just, we all just got together a lot of times, and I had a lot of Christmas and Thanksgiving things together.
Yeah.
And Della was cook for them, so I got a chance to enjoy a lot of that. But
tell me about school. Tell me, what are some of your earliest memories of going to school in Diboll?
Well, starting at the beginning, my sister took me out to enroll me in school.
That was Joy Mae?
Joy Mae.
Okay, took you to school.
And what happened that morning was very strange. I was so happy about the fact that I was fixing to start to go to school. At that time, they didn't have a kindergarten grade. You had to be 6 years old to start school. And she took me out there, and that particular day, and when I found the doctor, the teacher told her, said, "Well, you'll have to take Junior back to say he's not old enough to start the school yet." And man, that just hurt me. I was so sick about that. I think I cried all the way home. And then Joy took me back home and told Mama what happened. She had to go back to school. So that was my first experience of school. I didn't get a chance to spend a day.
Didn't get to go. So what? You weren't 6 yet?
I wasn't 6. See,
okay.
Me being born in February. Mm-hmm. That kind of put it off, you know. I had to wait until the next school term started. My burden, if I'd have been born close enough to when it started, September, I would have been able to.
So do you remember what your actual first day then? I mean,
I can't remember after the disappointment. It was a year later.
Okay.
I don't know that first day I went, but that was my very first experience in going to school, and I was so disappointed I couldn't stay. And
that's probably been about 35 then, huh?
Yeah, that would have been somewhere in there because. I wanted to go to school really bad because all the other kids that I played around with, they were my category was already going to school, and they seemed to be having so much fun. And of course, you know, when your school starts, all the kids around that age are in school, and you don't have nobody to play with.
So all your brothers and sisters were older than you? And
yeah, they all.
A good number of your
me.
Friends were older at that time?
Mm-hmm. Joy is the next one this month. She's next to me. Mm-hmm. And Ernest was next to her. Then Della. And Oscar. And then Johnny.
Okay.
Johnny was the oldest one.
Okay. Well, going back to the school, maybe not your first year or even second year, but what is some of your earliest memories of school? How many students would you have had in a class? Maybe teachers you remember?
Yes, I remember some of them. My first teacher was Miss Ruck. We had two teachers during my first year in school. Miss Henderson was my very first teacher. There was another teacher. I don't think she stayed here very long, but she, I can remember her being in my primary years, named Miss Piggy. And I talked to a lot of my classmates, and nobody could remember Miss Piggy, nobody but me.
Was that a nickname? Or?
No, I don't think so, because they referred to her as Miss Piggy, and I couldn't figure out whether that was a nickname or a real name. It could have been.
That's just how you knew her, huh?
That's all I knew about it. And so she, I think she stayed maybe a year, and then she went someplace else, I believe. But after then, after Miss Henderson, she was my primary teacher, and I remember her. She stayed a long time after Miss Piggy was here. And,
what was a typical school day like? How did the morning start off?
Well, about typical is an average morning. I think school started around about 8:30, and we were there and.
Everybody just walked to school or ride?
Everyone walked to school. And, you know, we didn't take a lunch because we all lived in the community and close enough to walk to school. School turned out at 12 o'clock. We came home and ate dinner and went back to school at 1. Got out at 3:45, I believe it was. So that was just routine for our, you know, activities as far as going and coming. We didn't have to take a lunch because if you remember, like when everybody ate about the same time here in Davao because the meal shut down, mm-hmm. Everybody went home and had to cook the meals and everything. That's what that cornbread whistle was all about.
Right.
You know, and to put
so even the schools. Even the schools
oh,
took
we
their
all,
lunch break at that
everybody,
time.
Everyone was tuned in to that
so everybody at Davao was eating lunch at the same
time.
Yeah,
at the same time. It's really something, you know. I'm starting to write a book, and I mentioned that in my book because it's just in a rough form right now. The manuscript is just all. I gotta get it all together. Mm-hmm. But I mentioned something to that effect. Like when we go home to eat lunch, all those houses that we pass by, you could hear those plates rattling and the knives and forks clinging together and everything. And you could actually smell the food. You know what they were having for dinner.
Now I imagine you had pretty good dinners with your father being the cook
yeah.
and having the cafe.
Oh yeah, mother was a good cook too. Herself, but her dad was he was more professional. Like he had the best barbecue. People would come from miles around to get his barbecue.
I want to ask you more questions about school, but I also forgot to ask you about your father's cafe. Do you ever remember who patronized your father? Any white people?
Yeah. Come? As a matter of fact, Miss Hall, if you may not remember her, she had a store.
Spell that last name?
H-A-L-L.
Hall, okay.
Mm-hmm. We used to get him to barbecue for her quite often. I don't know whether she was having family type of thing. And as a matter of fact, the night my daddy passed away, she had asked him to barbecue for her that Saturday, but he said he couldn't barbecue for her that Saturday because he had a lot of barbecue work to do for that weekend. In which he did. That was the same weekend that he passed away. But she had a store, and then there was two more stores, Wyatt store. And one more store up here is called Copestown. That building is still there. It's a two-story building. Mm-hmm. I think somebody's living in it right now. But there used to be another building built just on the same order, only it was over there next to Wyatt's store. It's called, there was Wyatt was...
spell that?
W-Y-A-T-T, I think
okay.
That's it.
Okay.
Laura Wyatt.
Wyatt.
But anyway, that was the store activities. We had one.
So they sold your father's barbecue at their stores?
Yeah, they sold him meat and what have you. But Dad bought a lot of his meat from the market here at the commissary. I remember going many times they would pick out, because they had the best choice of meat for barbecue.
So he got his meat from them. But I mean, as far as him selling his food, like in the evening, a typical evening, people are coming to your father's restaurant to eat. Did any white people come?
Yes. Matter of fact, they never really sat down and ate.
Okay.
They would come and order.
Okay.
And matter of fact, I can remember many times that they would come up and get an order of barbecue. One guy came up and Daddy had sold out of barbecue, and this white guy asked Dad, said, "Well, Jim, said, do you have any of that gravy?" You know, when he would barbecue, like the barbecue sauce, we call it today, you can buy it in a bottle, but Daddy had made up his own barbecue sauce, and that's what he would serve with his barbecue. And when he'd make a sandwich, you know, he'd put that on it. No, it was all homemade,
sauce.
And they wanted to just buy some of the sauce. And one guy came to the house one time, and he's a white guy. He wanted to get some barbecue, and Daddy didn't have any. He got mad. He came in the house and everything, and he was raising a whole lot of sand about that barbecue. Why we didn't have no barbecue? But I really think he had a few drinks.
that's what they call demand, isn't it?
Yeah, I tell you, that really was demand.
Supply and demand, and
yeah, but
the demand outran the
supply. Well, to tell you the truth, too, again, Jonathan, Daddy had a cafe in Henderson, Texas.
Okay, that's a good bit away from here.
Yeah, that's a good bit away from here. But I remember we had one photograph of him sitting on the outside of his cafe.
Now, was that while you were...
This was before I was born. So I was born in Davao.
Right.
But
I didn't know if he managed two at the same time or not.
No, he didn't. But it was called a stucco cafe.
Stucco.
Stucco, because it was built and had stucco on the outside, a stucco wall on it. In them days, and they called it the Stucco Cafe. And would you believe that when I opened mine, I had a cafe here too, and I named it the Stucco Cafe. Then I had the business and all that kind of stuff.
Now, did the Froggy Bottom Cafe did it outlive your father, or did it end when your father passed away?
Well, did you mean
or? You had mentioned your father had passed away.
Yes.
What year was that?
Well, that was in 1944.
44. Mm-hmm. Okay.
Well, we had done, Daddy had made.
So you would have been about 15.
I was 15.
15.
That was exactly what I was.
Okay.
And that Saturday, you know, I'll tell you about that, Daddy had barbecued for Miss Hall. I remember I told you about her when he had rolled up this meat. Well, she wanted him to barbecue for her, but he was barbecuing for himself and some more people at the time. But I wanted to go to the theater that Saturday because there was some kind of movie going on, matinee or whatever. And Daddy was making me stay there to watch him make up this meatloaf to go into the barbecue pit. And he was showing me step by step how he did it. And I've seen him do this many times, but this was the first time, Jonathan, that he had ever particularly wanted me to pay attention to what he was doing. So he made me stay for a little while, and I'm thinking, oh, I'm going to miss part of the movie, you know.
So you weren't paying attention.
I wanted to get on out of there, but he made me stay and watch him put it all together, and he told me how he seasoned it and all that, and rolled it up and tied it up in these little bundles and put it in the barbecue pit. And so and then he gave me 35 cents to go on to the movie. I went on to the movie. Now, Daddy had high blood pressure, and Dr. Dale had told him, Dr. Clement had told him that, you know, he shouldn't eat salt too much. And that was one of the bad things that he had a bad habit of. He just couldn't resist his own good cooking, I guess. And I came in from that movie that Saturday. And I came by the cafe, and I looked to my left, and that's where the door goes into the kitchen part of the cafe. And I saw Daddy was sitting there, and he was just enjoying himself eating that barbecue. And I thought about it. I said, are you not supposed to be eating that barbecue like that? And that night, I went, like the kids go out, and I had to be home about 9 o'clock. That Saturday, I came on, Mr. Walter Allen. his son and I are very close friends, so we always come home together. So he wasn't there that night, so at Miss Eva Dale's cafe where we would hang out at. So I just decided I'd come on home by myself. No one told me anything. I'm on my way home, and when I got home, I walked in the yard, Jonathan, and I walked in the yard. I saw my mother sitting on the porch, and my sister was over her with her arms around. I had no idea. And then when I walked up there, and I could see my mother was crying. And the people was, you know, no music was going on in the cafe. And everything was kind of quiet, and a few people was mingling around on the porch. And I asked my sister, what's the matter? And Mama never said anything, and my sister didn't say anything. And then when they saw I was getting excited, my mother told me to go in and look at my daddy. And I went in to look at him, and then he was on the bed. As bad what he had was a stroke, a heart attack. Mm. And, of course, that's what took his life. So that was that Saturday night on October the 10th, 1944. And so, you know, after then, you know, everything went to, I don't know, it just, my whole world was upside down then, because he was teaching me how to barbecue the way he did that same Saturday. Mm. You imagine that?
Wow, that's a special story.
Yeah.
So you then later had a cafe.
Yes.
I want to come back to that, but let's go back a little bit more to your school years, specifically the school. Mm. I know you played football.
Yeah.
You showed us a photograph, and of course you graduated, I think you told me, in 1948.
Yeah.
Tell me about the helmets that y'all wore. You were telling me something interesting the other day about that.
Okay. Well, during that time, you know, Bradley was our principal.
Charles Bradley. Okay.
And he also was a coach. So he did all those jobs, and he taught school. So we had a football team. The first football team we had only had seven guys on the team, six on the line and one in the backfield. So that was our football team. That was a six-man squad. And during that time, we didn't have any money to get the real helmets. So Bradley went to, I guess, the Army Navy store or something like that, and these leather helmets with the tank helmets, it really was.
Like Army tank
helmets. Army tank helmets, and that was what we used for helmets.
They're probably better than the football helmets.
They were leather, thick things, and very heavy. And we didn't have enough shoulder pads, but we just got along without them. Uh-huh. We had only a few pads, you know, for your hip pads on the side. That's about all we had.
Who were some of the schools that you played?
Oh, we, considering the district, we played like Zavala. We played Livingston. And they were much larger schools than we was at the time, Livingston especially. And I'm just thinking Seven Oaks. All of those little bitty towns around and surrounding we could get to.
Did you have any big rival? Was there a certain team every year that would be a rival forward to?
Well, we did not have any rivals that much. We would have had one if we'd have been a big enough school to play Lufkin.
Okay.
Dunbar and Lufkin were much larger schools, so we couldn't compete with them. And we did play football as far as Orange, Texas.
Oh, yeah, that's mm-hmm. a good way.
Yeah, and Orange, we played them, I remember, on two occasions, and they just beat us crazy. 58 to nothing, I believe it was, on one game. They had squads they could send there in every quarter, and they were all of them be different players. They just beat us so bad.
It wore y'all down, huh?
Yeah. Well, you see, Coach Smith was the coach down there, and you've heard of Bubba Smith. I know you have.
Uh-huh.
Bubba Smith. Well, that was his daddy.
His father. Okay.
Uh-huh. And he was from Orange, and Coach Smith and C.O. Bradley was very close friends. I think they had some college relationship.
Charles O'Neill Bradley
and Coach Smith.
Tell me a little bit more about Professor Bradley.
Well,
what you remember about him?
Well, the one thing stands out in my mind about Bradley, when he first came to Diboll, it was really not a high school because we didn't have enough students to qualify as a high school at that particular grade level. But he did something that was very strange, and it worked. We had enough guys walking around the streets who should have been in school but wasn't going. So he took the names of those boys and put them on the roster, even though they weren't going to school, when he turned this in to qualify for a high school accreditation. And it worked. Now, the superintendent, Mr. Pate, at the time, accepted this type of thing. I maybe it was an agreement, I'm not sure. But because with the kids that was coming along, that next year would have been enough kids to establish us as a high school. But since this was his first year and he just came here, this is what he did.
It was about 42 or so?
That was somewhere in there, around about 40. It was just before the war.
Okay.
I know because I remember he was there during the war, when 1941, because his wife was there in 1940. War started in 1941, wasn't it?
December 7th. December 7th. That's when we entered. December
well, 7th. I remember her, being in her class that morning. She said that she was the one that broke the news to us that we were in war. Notice she said the Japanese declared war on the United States. And declared? I mean, what's that? Didn't know we were fixing to go to war.
Yeah. Well, that's okay. I was just for
but Bradley,
time reference,
well, that was one of the things that he did to create this, to start a high school. And
so you were just about getting to high school age then
just,
at the time. Yeah.
Well, I was not quite
not
in
quite
high
there.
School when
yeah,
he came.
Yeah.
But I was, you know, pretty close.
But it was a big enough event that you were aware of it even at the time.
Oh, I was aware of it at the time. But I really didn't know for some time after then that this was what he did to make that happen.
Right.
But I was told about it later on. And it worked real good. And from then on, you know, we were able to maintain it as a high school, the crop of kids coming
and
along.
And actually graduate and get a diploma that meant something.
And get a diploma, right. And he did one other little trick, too, that happened to save us again on that. When I graduated, there was three other students in the 11th grade, but they weren't. Something happened here that they weren't going to have a 12th grade the next year. However, that was, they was allowed to take the 12th grade with us and then go back to school and take the 11th and then graduate as 11th grade. If you can understand that.
Okay.
Well, at any rate, it worked again, and from then on, it sustained itself pretty good.
Tell me about Eddie Mae Bradley, Bradley's wife.
Mm-hmm.
You mentioned that you were in her class when
yes.
you got news of Pearl Harbor.
Right.
What else can you remember about her?
She, well, one thing about it, I remember we all thought she was the prettiest teacher that ever came there. And she was a beautiful lady. But at any rate, I was in her class on I'm trying to think what class she taught us. I think it was history. And history, yeah, I think it was. Anyway, Miss Bradley was a beautiful woman, and I think everybody just fell in love with her because, you know, she was just pretty. And you might have seen the pictures.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, she's just pretty and everything, and she was just a regular teacher. When I graduated, she was very close to my sister, who was in college at the time.
That's Joy Mae.
Joy Mae.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Where did she go to college?
Jarvis Christian College.
Jarvis, okay. Mm-hmm.
And then she left there. When she left there, I think she took a year or so at Prairie View. Now, Miss Bradley, Joy Mae and I graduated on the same night. I graduated from high school. She graduated from college. She's 4 years older than me. Now, my mother had a choice of going to my graduation or going to Joy's graduation. So my mother and Miss Bradley said, well, I'm going to go to Joy May's graduation, and you can go to Junior. They all call me Junior. And you go to Junior. So that's how my mother went to my graduation, and Miss Bradley went to Joy May's. And that was something interesting. And we couldn't change the date on that one.
No, you sure could. Tell me a little bit about, kind of switching gears here, but Eddie Mae Bradley, I know as much of her as anything through the little articles that she wrote in the Buzzsaw.
Mm-hmm.
And if I'm mistaken, you tell me, but I think one time you had told me years ago that maybe Mr. Daniel, Shirley Daniel,
yeah, I worked
ran the
for
paper,
him. Mm-hmm.
Or maybe Mr. Templer, somebody put you in touch, access to a camera.
Yes.
Tell me a little bit about that. And I think, if I remember right, you told me it was in the context of, mm-hmm, at the time you didn't really appreciate what they were trying to get you to do as far as document
right,
the community and
right,
you have a regret
right,
in that regard. Tell a little bit more.
I really didn't know what Mr. Jake Durham was trying to tell me to do. As a matter of fact,
Jake Durham,
yeah,
okay.
I was working for Shirley Daniel. I kept the theater. I was a janitor there, and I kept his yard
at
clean.
The Timberland Theater.
He's the one I was telling you about all the money. And actually, Mr. Jake Durham's told me, Jim, I'm going to get you a camera, a little Brownie reflex. I think they cost about $3.50, and a roll of film. And so he said, Paul Durham was associated, I think they can, I think, some kind of way. He ran the other paper after them. But anyway, Mr. Jake Durham said, I want you to take pictures of all the schools, just to take pictures of everywhere, all around, you know, and get, you know, we'll write something about it. So I did.
This is for the Buzzsaw newspaper?
Yeah, well, it was for him.
Just for him, okay.
Yeah, so he was the one to put them in the papers.
Okay.
So I took pictures all around. Everybody thought I was so popular with the camera. Nobody else had one. No. I took pictures and everything. I didn't have much money to put them in the shop to get them out. So when I take the roll out, I'd give them to Mr. Jake Durham, and he would process them. And many of the pictures I never did get a chance to see that I took, but I remember taking them. Mm-hmm. And some of them I did. But then I managed to get, since I was working for Mr. Daniel, we bought the camera, right? He used to have a little jewelry store, right? Section, right, built in with the Timberland Theater. You could go in there and buy a little jewelry, little stuff like that. And they had these cameras, and that's where I got it. So you could put your film in there. So I was able to put a few film in there as I got paid, and I was only getting $3.50 a week. but that was pretty good money in those days, especially when you didn't have anything. So.
And that was money from working at the theater,
right. Okay. Yeah, I was swept it up. But I found, sometimes I would actually find money sweeping up that people had dropped, you know, and couldn't find it in the dark, and by the time I got all the trash down the front and started to pick it up, there would be all kinds of little change down in there. So that was another supplement for me.
That was your tip.
Yeah, that was my tip.
So how long did that last, taking pictures?
It lasted, I'd say it lasted better than a year, I'm sure.
Okay.
You know,
because
it lasted like during the school session.
Okay, so you were a student then?
Yeah, I was a student then. I was only about 16 years old, 15, 16 years old.
So this would have actually been before the Buzzsaw, I guess.
Well, it might have been
I think the Buzzsaw started in 48.
48?
Yeah.
Well,
maybe 47, I don't remember,
right.
But
They must have had something. I don't remember when this Buzzsaw started. It's pretty good.
Yeah. Well, Jake, I think, you know, he was with the human resources, but that was as much like public relations too. What the company was doing.
Right.
And of course, you know, the Buzzsaw when it did come in was a employee relations and that kind of thing.
Right, but the afterthought about all of that, Mr. Jake Durham was trying to get me to do was take pictures of just kind of recording things, you know.
To document.
Document, but I didn't quite understand the purpose. If I had known then what he really had in mind, I would have been taking pictures of buildings and things that we would really appreciate having today, because some of those buildings are torn down, long gone, and no pictures of them.
So, any pictures of Froggy Bottom? Cafe?
Yeah, well, no pictures, but I did a drawing of Froggy Bottom.
Okay.
And I did a drawing of all of the cafes and restaurants, little cafes and things that where the kids would go. At Southside, Froggy Bottom, the Bright Spots, Eva Dell's Cafe. Those are drawings of Number 2 Store, Laura Store. I have pencil drawings of those for my book. So...
Just one more clarification. When your father passed away, was that the end of the cafe, the Froggy Bottom Cafe?
Or? Well, relatively it was, because you see, I was not quite big enough to assume any kind of responsibilities like that, and I didn't really know what was going to happen. I thought perhaps my mother would just take it over, you know, but she didn't have the expertise that Daddy had, and I found out, you know, she could not have kept it going that way. So it came to a point where we were just in the process about to leave Dyball, because see, my daddy wasn't working for the company,
right?
And being that he now had passed away. And I'm just 15, wasn't a way I could do it. And one of my brothers was living in Trinity, so I think they had talked, and I remember one day mother had me to get ready and tell them at school that I was leaving, and I had to turn my books in and everything. And, you know, I didn't have no idea what we was going to do, but we were going to Trinity. And we went to Trinity, and we stayed that day. And for some reason, I don't think my mother really liked her. So something happened with my other brother, who wanted mama to come back to Dyball and we find some place to stay. So we came back, but we wasn't having to move right then. You know, we apparently she'd got the word, but we hadn't moved then. So she came back, and the process of coming back. One person, my brother in Crockett, was living in Trinity. That was the one that we went to visit. So when we got back, mother must have made some arrangements with somebody. I think it was he's the guy that he and his wife was killed in that train accident, remember, up here.
Stubblefield.
Mm-hmm. Okay. So he told her, you know, where she could just stay on there and everything would be all right, and she'd have to have plenty of time to do what she had to do. So mother got married to Mr. Carter. Now Mr. Carter was a very well-known man that the Temples brought from Texarkana, and he worked for the mill for a long time. And
what
so
was his first name?
Henry Carter.
Henry Carter.
Mm-hmm. He's very, very, he was very much liked by Mr. H.G. Temple. He came with the first group that came to Dyball, I guess, I won't say the first group, but during that particular time, among some of the first people who came to from Texarkana with them here. So then after she got married to him, then that was reestablishing us, and it was a really good thing. And he was really a great father to me. So this is.
So this was in your teenage year?
Yes, it was my teenager's year.
Okay.
And he lived until that year that I graduated from Asia. I think he died in 1947. And then next year I graduated. And then after then, I didn't really know what I was going to do.
So you lost two fathers.
I lost two fathers, right.
School.
Mm-hmm. And they both was just real. I couldn't have had a better stepfather in this world. That my daddy was, you know, we were just buddies, you know. Mr. Carter was just the same way. He taught me. See, I went to work for a temple when I got out of school right away. And he told me about all of the dangers and things, how to be careful out there about this, that, and the other, because he has seen all these.
Mr. Carter did.
And he briefed me on everything to be careful about. And I, sure enough, I'm glad he did, because he told me about that fighting the bear. You know, this was a job, and I did get that opportunity to do that. What it is lumber that comes off of the green chain, and it goes through these saws, and then you have to kick that bark over to the side and let the good part pass this. But you always had to be watching it because it's just coming at you all the time. That's what he was telling me.
Sometimes it can shoot out pretty fast.
Pretty fast. So he said, always keep your eyes on that saw. Never take them off. And I'm telling you, he was sure right about that. The little hole is no bigger than about that, and you're down in here. So you ain't got too much. You can just move over to the side and let it get by.
Fought the bear? Who had that job? Was it mostly black people? White?
No,
white and black?
It was some white that was fighting that bear. It was just mostly us.
Was it inexperienced people? I mean, was it typically...
In my case, it was inexperienced.
I mean, was that your... Your orientation?
No.
into the sawmill business?
Or, well, not really. No, we had some very easy jobs when I first went to work for them because, you know, we didn't have to do a lot of hard work. Well, but we were straightening sticks on these stacks where they stacked the lumber.
And
we had to straighten those sticks from all that.
And they were stacked a certain way so they would air dry.
So
they
air dry them, but they had to be straightened. Every time they put a layer on them, they had to put them sticks on them because that's keep you rolling. So
you just walked around and did that, right?
Yeah, mm-hmm, okay. Just walked around, just kept it. They had the
straight
sticks already there, so you know, when they got that layer finished, and you just stack them on that like that.
Yeah, yeah.
Mm-hmm. And then they stacked the other lumber, but... That was a really interesting job. They had plenty of jobs there that was kind of hard, but youngsters, like real young guys, couldn't really do them. Like standing on those stacks would be 8 and 10 feet high.
Yeah.
And those guys were just, I remember them stacking that lumber every day like that. You could hear those planks falling all across town and everything. It was very, very... When 12 o'clock noon came, it looked like everything just quieted down. It seemed like there was just a vacuum. And then as soon as 1 o'clock come, you could hear it crawling up again.
All that machinery.
Machinery started going and everything. Uh-huh.
Belts and the pulleys.
Belts and pulleys and clinging and clatting and all that.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
We're jumping back chronologically, but I think I just remembered you had told me once before about when you were... a child or maybe even a teenager, but tell me about fishing at the mill pond and getting the worms out of the logs and stuff like that.
I was looking at that picture out there, you know, the picture with all the people on it,
mm-hmm,
right out here. You can see where the trains used to come, and there was a tilted roll-off that
Where the log cars would be inclined,
right,
so the logs
would
roll into the pond.
Right, right. Okay. Now, that was the famous place for catching these big brim, we call them. Perch, uh-huh. And we would go out there, and there was always fish to be caught. We didn't have to worry about any bait, because we'd take a knife and those pine trees where the bark is, mm-hmm, just peel that bark off, and we call them sawyers, but they were... There's little white worms in there, and that's what we used to make.
Little grub worms.
Grub worms, uh-huh. I guess that was about, I don't know what they call them today, pine beetles or something like that.
Did you have actual hooks or barbed hooks?
We had actual hooks. We used mostly, we didn't have any artificial, we didn't have any rod and reel, so used cane poles.
What kind of line did you use? Was it actual, was it monofilament or...
No, my daddy used number 8 sewing thread.
Sewing thread.
Number 8 sewing thread was the best. It was tension enough, strong enough to just about hold any brim you're going to catch. Uh-huh. I wouldn't know, say about 5-pound bass, it'd take pole and all, but that's what he used.
Okay, what would you use for a rod or for a pole?
Well, we use bamboo. We go out and cut them. You know, they grow all around here.
Yeah.
We didn't have to buy them or anything. Like, just go down there and cut them.
Try to get the longest one, huh?
Yeah. But Dad always kept a lot of, he'd go and cut a bunch and they dry out. Uh-huh. I got some at home right now.
Okay.
Man, hang them up and let them dry straight.
Right,
so,
right,
mm-hmm,
right.
Well, anyway, that's what we use, a number 8 sewing thread and a shank hook. And a goose feather. That was all we needed. We'd go out there and catch all the fish.
Tell us what the goose feather was for.
Well, this is your float. You see, you strip the the feather part off of that quill,
uh-huh.
And then you put a little hole in it, and then you run your line through it, and then that floats. And then you got your float, and then you got your line and your hook. And you just throw it out there, and you just keep right on going with the fish kit and come bringing them in. I remember Mr. Walter Allen and Daddy, they were very close friends. They went out on the pond there.
And Walter Allen, just for the tape, was the foreman of the mill pond.
Yeah, right.
Yeah. I'm sorry,
yeah.
Go ahead.
Yeah, anyway, him and Daddy went out there one day, and they caught 98 brim. They were all big as my hand. Boy, man, they come back with all them fish. Boy, we had a ball that day. And I guess, you know,
Did you have to clean them all?
No.
Who cleaned them?
Daddy did.
He didn't have you help?
Not much for me. Well, one time I was really surprised at one of the biggest speaking of fishing, at Ryan's Lake down here, Daddy had a trout line set out down there. And he caught a catfish, and that catfish weighed 90 pounds.
Wow.
It took him and Mr. Charlie Lee Carter and Mr. Earl, I guess between, I wasn't down there, but somehow or another they had this big line. I guess typically they could catch catfish like this all the time down there.
Mm-hmm. What about 2.5-3 feet long was standard,
yeah. Mm-hmm. And some of the species, I guess, died out because we don't see any of those spoonbill cats anymore. You know, I don't know what happened to them. But they catch lots of fish. It was really good fishing between the mill ponds
and the river.
Ryan's Lake.
Oh, the Ryan's Lake, okay.
Mm. So it was pretty easy for us to make a living, too, Jonathan. It was really, in a sense, you know, considering if you really was hungry, you could find some way to feed your family.
Yeah. Mm. Tell me a little bit about Professor Jackson, the man who taught Harry James how to play the trumpet.
And he also taught me how to play the piano.
All right.
I didn't, and my sister took lessons from him, but I was just fooling around. I didn't have time.
Professor William Jackson, right?
Yeah, Will Jackson.
Will Jackson.
Now, he was really, you know, he when he walked, he'd make real short steps. I remember, and he carried this sachet with him. He was like a mail carrier for Southern Power. I don't know what was in there, but they must have had some kind of mail transaction between...
I think he worked for TSC Railroad.
Yeah, it was.
He was delivering shipping bills or something.
Oh, something like that.
Yeah, go ahead. So he had a little sachet.
Right, okay. He'd have that little sachet with him all the time. I never knew what was in it, but he would always be with him, and he would see him when the trains come in and all that kind of stuff. But he played every musical instrument that I could imagine. I mean, from the trumpet, the saxophone, the piano. And he did play with W.C. Handy's band. Now, I don't know if you all have that tape or not, but Mr. Nielsen gave me the tape that was where he was interviewed.
I think
you got one?
I think so.
Okay, if you have one, I can get you one.
KSPL radio interview? Was
yes,
it the KSPL radio? Okay, I think that's
the one.
The
KRBA.
KRBA, okay.
Yeah, I loved it. Okay. Mm-hmm. Okay. And they interviewed him, and he told him about his experience with W.C. Handy. And he had...
Describe his walk.
Well,
I'm trying to remember how you described it one time before.
Well, he...
You used the word stride.
Yeah, right.
He had a certain stride.
He had a certain kind of stride. He kind of read back when he walked. But he would make kind of short steps, you know.
So he leaned back a little bit.
Yeah, kind of leaned back a little.
Right? I think the way you told me once before that he it was obvious, or certainly, and the reason why I think it's important is because I've talked to a lot of people that remembered him, but nobody's mentioned that but you.
Yeah.
But and I can't get it right, but you said it was almost like he had a tune, he had a beat in his mind always, and you could just tell it in his walk.
Yeah, you could tell in his walk, and he would always be checking his watch a lot of times. I never knew why.
That came from being a railroad man.
Yeah, I guess so. He would put out his watch.
He always checked his watch.
Always checking his watch. But I think because he walked the way he did, might have been because of that sachet he was carrying.
Okay.
I often thought about that because he'd always have it strapped on him and it'd be right around about here. So it seemed kind of like he'd be leaning back a little bit, but his steps would be kind of short. You know, they wouldn't be like striding like that. It would just kind of be short steps when he'd walk. See, he married my cousin. You might have seen her.
What was her name?
Miss Emma Jackson.
Okay.
She had 1, 2, 3. I think she had 4 sisters. I don't remember all of them name, but they were all sisters, and they all came out of Nicton, and my grandma Betty is on my grandmother's side of the family. So, and he married Miss Emma, and you have her in his picture, I think. If you don't, I can get you one.
You said he taught you how to play the piano.
Mm-hmm.
How did those lessons go?
Well, with me, I didn't stick with it long enough to really, because I my sister did. She stuck with it pretty good and learned how to read music. But it was reading the music I didn't want to get off into. I just played by ear.
Okay.
So then I just.
But he actually read music.
Oh yeah.
Yeah.
He wrote music, and you know something? That's another thing. Before I wasn't here when he passed away, but he lived in a small house by himself at the time, and he was like about 90. At that time, the last time I remember seeing him good to talk to him, he was in his 90s, but I think he was like 102 or 103 when he died.
Yeah, I think so.
But anyway, he had papers and everything in this old trunk of all of his music and stuff. I remember he had a lot of documents. I never saw it to look at them individually. I never did. But I knew he had them there. So apparently, I wasn't here when he died and when they buried him. But
what became of those
papers?
That's what
I'm saying. Whatever happened to all of that, that was a treasure that we should never let
go. Because that was original music that he wrote.
Original music.
Oh, wow. That'd be something.
It would have been something. See, a lot of people don't see the value in it because they think it's just nothing.
Yeah.
So they just throw it away.
Did you ever get a chance to ask your cousin what happened to it? Or did she not know?
No, because Cousin Emma passed away first.
Oh, okay, okay.
Uh-huh.
Okay, she'd already. Yeah,
and I was in Seattle at the time. See, when I left here, I went to Seattle after I finished.
Yeah, tell me a little bit about that. So you graduated from school. How long was it before you left Dieball after graduating?
Let's see. I graduated and my brother came that Christmas. That would have been December. Let me see. About 6 months. 6 or 8 months.
And you were saying that you left because you had a brother that lived in
Seattle. Yes, I had a brother that lived in Seattle. He came home during the Christmas. And during that time, I had a scholarship to Tillerson College.
Tillerson?
Tillerson.
Tillerson.
I think this is still a credit school.
Okay.
But that was in Austin. And I didn't know anyone there. I didn't have any relatives there. So then, too, my sister was graduating from college, same year I graduated from high school. And we were kind of looking forward to her getting a job and kind of sponsoring me through. Because we didn't really have any money. So it would have been me away from home, and what am I going to do?
So you never went?
I never went.
You never went.
No, I never went to Tillerson.
Even though you had
But I went to, when I went to Seattle, I still had a little time in the second semester going into Roosevelt High School, so I post-graduated. You can do that, you don't get a diploma. Because you already got it.
So you went to a school called Roosevelt High School in Seattle,
right,
Washington.
Uh-huh, okay. Right. But you might be able to do that, but at that time, schools were not as crowded as they are now.
What was it like to move from Dieball, Texas, which I think you had said you'd never really been been far away from home, and then all of a sudden now to go to Seattle?
Well, there's a little funny story behind that one. Well, when I got to Seattle, I really tell you, it was raining when I got there, and it rained every day. It rained every day, every day. And I just couldn't understand why. When is this rain going to let up? So I guess I'd been there about a month, maybe a month and a half, or 2 months, could have been. It seemed like 2 months at least. I woke up that morning, I looked out the window, and I saw this great big mountain over there. And my brother's girlfriend, I called to her and said, "Lizzie, come here, let me show you something." I looked out, I said, "Look at that big mountain out there."
You'd never seen it before.
No, it's a cloud and rain and everything. So, and when it wasn't raining, they had all that overcast. So she said, "Yeah, Jim," said, that's Mount Rainier. I said, "Wow, it sure is big." And she's the one that told me if I let the rain stop me from going anywhere, I never would go anywhere. But anyway, after then, what some good things happened to me while I was in Seattle. Some funny things too. Being from Texas, and to be honest, I was still like kind of shy about going places. I didn't know where I could go that I'd be really welcome. So, you know, in a big city here, you know, and I'm just wanting to go someplace. So.
Was Seattle segregated?
No.
Okay.
As a matter of fact, it was just, that's what I'm getting at. I had, when I got to Seattle, my brother never told me.
So it wasn't just being new in a new town, but the intermixing of whites and blacks.
That's right. Well, you see, when Lizzie told me that if I let the rain stop me from going anywhere in Seattle, I never would go nowhere. So she said, "Why don't you get on the bus and ride downtown and get your round trip ticket and come back and just see what you think?" I said, "Okay, I think I can do that by myself."
Did you have to ride at the back of the bus?
No, that's what I'm telling you.
Okay.
I went and got on the bus. There were plenty of empty seats all up in the front, you know, people all mixed up in the back. And I looked around and said, "Where am I going to sit?" So I said, "Well, I'm going on back to the back." So I went on to the back and I sat down, and that's where I'd ride the bus. Every time I get on, I go straight on to the back.
But you could have ridden in the front if you wanted.
I could have sat on the first seat. But I could have sat up there with the driver. It wouldn't matter. But, you know, I didn't. I just, you know, it hadn't sank in to me. And every place, there was no segregation nowhere. I mean, you could just go where you wanted to.
So that was quite a shock in the other sense. Huh?
That's right. It really was amazing. That was the good thing about Seattle.
Now, when you rode the train, how did you get to Seattle? Did you go by train?
You went by train.
Okay. And that was segregated, wasn't it?
Well, I tell you what happened. We went from here to Shreveport.
Shreveport. Okay.
We got to Shreveport. We got on the train, and the train that we got on in Shreveport, as it went north going towards Seattle, I don't know exactly what route it, but it stopped at several places, and people started to get on the train. And that's when I noticed that everybody's white and black was getting on the train, just sitting where they want to and everything. And by the time we got up around Idaho, a place like that, it was all mixed up, white and black.
All mixed up.
And we got into Idaho. Another thing about that trip, we hit a snow bank. It was snowing so bad until the train had to stop. And we stayed in one place for 20 hours.
Wow.
That was something. They had to bring us all blankets and everything. So, you know, to me, it didn't matter. I wasn't in a hurry. But, you know, they brought us, and then they gave us sandwiches and stuff like that until another snow train met us from the front, my brother was telling me. And then apparently cleared the way, and then we were taken on off of Seattle. That was a good experience.
So that would have been late 40s?
Yeah, that would have been...
48, 49?
Yeah, well, that would have been... you know, he had, like during the Christmas, that would have been around December, somewhere in there in the 40s. Well, you know, I graduated in 48,
right.
See. So it would have been 40-something, about 49, something,
okay,
48.
Christmas 49.
Mm-hmm, right. So, see, then while I was up there, I went to work for Boeing Aircraft Company.
Boeing?
Boeing.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. They're the one that sent me to school and taught me how to read blueprint. And that was a good education because they paid for it. And the school was locally right there, mm-hmm, on the premises, so I didn't have to go like someplace else. But they taught me how to read blueprints, and it was the beginning of my engineering, you might say, my first exposure to some kind of engineering. And we were converting B-29s into B-50s for Great Britain.
Hmm.
That's some kind of modification. That's how I got the job. And then that's when I got my letter, too, from being inducted into the service. The Korean War was going on then.
Uh-huh.
But then my sister...
So you joined the Army?
I didn't join. They drafted you.
Okay.
Yeah, see,
to the Army?
Army, uh-huh.
Okay.
See, well, my mother had me go down to the post office and register when I was 18, right here.
In Davao?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, okay. So
the Selective Service, they referred that, and I was already in Seattle, man.
And they found you in Seattle.
So she said, man, you got to come home, and they're going to send it. So, I came on home, so because I had some time in between. When they first notify you, they ain't calling in. But then later on, they called me to have my physical and stuff like that after I had gotten here. And that was during '50s. But I tell you, it was just a good experience to be able to go to Seattle in the first place. And my mother wanted me to see what the other side of the country was like.
Yeah. Well, I bet that really was quite an experience to
see.
It
really was.
Not, the integration of the races.
It really was. Well, especially with me because I was so used to the segregation.
Mm-hmm.
But that was not, something that I could just make a turnaround on and say, hey, everything's all of a sudden, everything's different. I had to sort of blend in with the thing.
Take it a little slow and easy.
But everybody was like open up. You know, actually, Jonathan, I had to look hard to find black people in Seattle. It just wasn't a lot of us there. If they were, we were just spread it out so thin until you just didn't see us at all.
Yeah.
And we lived anywhere.
What about at Boeing?
How many
blacks?
Well,
did you intermix with the whites there? Did they keep the blacks together?
Oh, sure. Everything was integrated.
Everything was integrated, didn't it?
Everything. I can't think of anything in Seattle that wasn't integrated.
Okay, okay.
Nothing, as a matter of fact. They were...
The school that you went to was integrated.
They didn't have any black schools in Seattle.
there weren't enough.
You went to school. Save that money. But it was just all in the people. There, you will find a mixture of races like Indians. See, Seattle's Indian chief. I think that's what it was named after. But anyway,
Japanese?
Oh, yes. Yeah. Chinese. Oh, you found lots of Chinese, Japanese, and Filipinos. And that was basically what, as I could see, a mixture of different kind of races. But they were all had their little... Now, China had their own little... You know, it's like Chinatown?
Mm-hmm.
I guess that's true maybe with a lot of big cities. There's always a Chinatown. So we'd go to Chinatown, we'd go over to Tacoma, Washington, Chinese, run that whole place. They gamble a lot over there. And I was too young to get in those gambling places. It was really against the law. We had to go and look through a little deal like this. I went over there with my brother. I said, I'm not going in there. It was kind of funny. But we had a lot of fun in Seattle for the time I was there. And I'd like to go back, really, just to visit.
I see we've gone about an hour and 15 minutes. Can you believe it's been that much time?
Well, we
generally try to keep the interviews to about that length. And, I'm sure we've got other things to talk about. But before we wrap this one up, like I said, I mainly wanted to concentrate on your early years in Dimebaugh. But I know you've got... a lot of other experiences, but is there anything else for this interview? Like I said, we might can do another one in the future, but for this interview, anything that we didn't talk about that you would like to bring out?
Well, growing up in Dimebaugh, this is a lot of experiences we had here. just as kids, what you really remember a lot about Dimebaugh, in my case, was like when you were growing up.
Mm-hmm.
Actually you get grown, you just do other things. But growing up here, we had there were some people here that weren't too good, and some was very good. Among the white people and black people and how they got along. But we seemed to manage to get along really good with all the basic white people. But there were some people, like we had an old law here named Jay Bowens at one time. Mm-hmm. He was hired by the Temples of Revived Pastors or something, but he took on the title like he was a Texas Ranger, and he wasn't really a Texas Ranger. He might have been a ranger and ride the range and pastors and stuff like that. But, you know, they ran him out of St. Augustine because he established such a bad reputation.
And he killed him.
Yeah, he killed. Yeah, he killed. But not just in Diboll, but other. That's why they got rid of him over there. I had heard later, because he came to my daddy's cafe when he first came to Diboll, and he told me, "Well, Jim, said I heard you've been selling whiskey." And daddy told him, "Mom," and I was in the cafe when he came in there. And daddy said, "Yes, I said, yes, sir, I sure was." He said, "But when I heard you was coming, that's when I quit." He said, "Because I know that if I kept going at it, you was going to come here and we were going to have a time about it." That's the way daddy put it. So I didn't know what he was talking about. But daddy said, he didn't get, otherwise, Jay Bowen just, he left it that way. He didn't bother me anyway otherwise.
Did he ever come back any other times? Jake
no,
Warren?
He never came back to bother us anymore. Daddy had a pretty good reputation with a lot of good people around here. You know, he didn't really, well, he wasn't, you know, he was a good service to the community, really, because of the things that he did. You know, barbecue, and he's a blacksmith. He built all these different kinds of things. He built me a violin. You wouldn't believe it. I couldn't even know my daddy could do such a thing. I mean, I don't know what happened to it, but it got out of the family some kind of way. But anyway, those people that was not so good, well, you know, they were just, I think they were just sort of overbearing, because we saw incidents happen at ballparks over there. Like, we'd have baseball game, Jay Barnes and his debutants would come over, and they'd just look us over, you know, and look at, I'm just a young kid, it didn't bother me, but those grown-ups, man, they would just try to pick at them to make them do something, talk about them, or you drinking or whatever, just put something in.
Sort of antagonistic.
Antagonistic, you know, so just try to do something like that.
Now these baseball games, did many white people attend them? I'm assuming talking about it's black team versus a black team.
Well,
or did the black teams play the white teams?
Well, one time they did.
Okay.
But we had.
Now, are we talking about over? But on the west side of town or over here?
Over west side of town. So
okay,
we had our own baseball.
Right, okay.
And one section over here was for the whites. Mm-hmm. They had a greater section over here for the blacks. But this whites, it was just to be just as many of them over there, as many times it would be over here.
Watching the black
watching
teams
the black.
Play.
So they had a good baseball team.
Yeah, okay.
Everybody liked them. And,
so Jay Bourne would come over there with his deputies.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, he would antagonize me.
Would you say that he antagonized maybe the blacks more than he did the whites?
Oh, well, he had a bad reputation with everybody.
Okay.
That's why they ran him out of St. Augustine. I'm understanding that. But he just kind of put a big feather in his hat, like he was boss about everything. And he, matter of fact, he had a daughter, and I don't know, he was just a terrible guy. You know, he was always getting into things, and she ended up being, you know, kind of like a little tramp, you know. I don't know what happened. She was just, instead of being, you know, a little more sophisticated, and so she just went down for whatever reason. Because I saw her sitting on the side of my nephew's cleaners on the ground out there one day. You know, that was kind of strange, you know. So I don't know what was going on, but, you know, you think something's wrong. But anyway, he was not too good a guy. He wasn't really well liked. I think they knew that, but they had to put up with him. And Mr. Fogg was his sidekick.
Fogg, F-O-G-G.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I remember when he got killed out here at the mill, you know, he got cut up by the...
Fell into the hip saw.
Right. And, Mr. Fogg never did really... He wasn't that way. He was just there, you know. We never seen him ravishing anybody or anything like that. He was just with him. But
did you actually see Jay Bourne get physical with anybody?
Oh yeah, he beat up my nephew Marcellus. Yeah, in his own yard, and I saw him beat up another guy called T.L. Jones, and then they tell me he got beat up, Jay Bourne got beat up by a black woman. Now, I wasn't there, but I don't know who told me that story. But anyway, she beat him up or something. I don't know what happened there. But
I heard one time somebody say, you know, Jay Bourne was a small man.
He was small.
But he thought he was much bigger as long as he had that pistol.
As long as he had that pistol.
Phrased it.
That's what made him, maybe that was what his problem was. He felt real big as long as he had that big gun on him. And he always did. And I think he anybody could beat him up. As a matter of fact, I think his son-in-law or something like that beat him up really bad one time right here. He wasn't a bad guy. I mean, he without his gun, he was nothing. Yeah, it's because a couple of guys called him out on that. Black guys. Mm-hmm. I told him, you put that gun down and I'll walk you out of here. And he wouldn't do it. As a matter of fact, they got into a confrontation. It was Jay Bourne's wife that broke him up. Mm. So, but now he did some other things. You know, Jay Bourne's killed George Andrews here in Dyball, right in front of the Calaboose here. And I remember that Saturday night. Mm. And shot him right through the head. Mm. Right there. And we went out there and we could see the bullet hole in there. Yeah, it's a bitter with the sweet, you know. It's just in life you're going to have some of both. And there's always somebody to do something like that. Mm. But I don't think he was well liked by anybody too much. It just wasn't black people. He just had to have his way about being the boss. I think what might have given him some of that attitude was the fact that he had this job that Mr. H.G. Temple had given him to safeguard his, you know, pastors and things riding around. He just overdid his authority, you know. He didn't have to do some things he did to keep the peace. He would create a problem to make it look like he was doing his job. Hmm. So, but that was bad because a lot of the people, you know, that he was harassing, they was here and they were employees, and he was about to make it so bad till some of them was really they was just waiting on an opportunity to do something to him. They just didn't have an opportunity to do it, so he probably lucked out that way, you know, but that was really bad for all of us. But I'm sure J.L. Rohn, you know him.
Who?
J.L. Rohn.
Rohn? R-H-O-N-E?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Mr. Rohn?
His name's out there on
there.
Well, you know, Jay Bowens had really talked to him about, he was really regretting the things that he did here. Matter of fact, he cried about him to him, and he was so sorry. He was able to apologize for a lot of things that he did. And J.R. told me about it. See, we were classmates.
And this is James Rohn?
James Rohn, you know
him. Okay. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
He is my classmate. And he was telling me about it, and I said, well, you know, I guess it's never too late to apologize, but it hurt a lot of people in the process. Mm-hmm. So it might have made him feel a little bit better about himself if he did apologize. But who do you apologize to? Mm-hmm. You know, the people that he should have been apologizing to might have should have been somebody close to the people that he did wrong. But I guess you don't have an opportunity to do that if they're not around. So, but anyway, he's quite a legend. I don't never see his picture. You know, I don't know.
We've got a few pictures of him.
Well, the only picture I remember, he was standing in front of the commissary, right where the flag used to be.
Uh-huh.
And he's standing there with his gun on the side. It's Jay Bourne.
Well, I think you put it a good way a while ago, and you said the bitter with the sweet. You know,
That's life anyway.
Sad that you know anybody had to experience hardships like that.
Well, yeah, you know, history is something, Jonathan, I look at from the standpoint of it's in the past, and it's all right to talk about it. And a lot of things we like to talk about, the good stuff, but that ain't all the history.
Right.
You know, it's just you have to face the music and dance. That's the way I see it.
Yeah, yeah.
But I think it's the best way to put something behind you.
Right.
Yeah, really. You have to bring it out and open.
Right.
Talk about it.
Well, I see we're at just under an hour and a half.
Yeah.
And like I said, I know there's a lot of other things we need to talk about, but
yeah.
An interview session, it's really best to try to keep it a little bit, and we can come back and review this, and then I'm sure there'll be follow-up questions that'll come to mind as we look at this. And
have to think of something, jot it down as a question. We get back together and we think of something else.
Okay, well, again, I sure appreciate your time and willingness to help this out. And again, this is all part of collecting, preserving, and providing access to our history. And oral history is unique in the sense that it's each individual's personal experiences and memories, things that aren't necessarily written down anywhere.
Yeah.
And it's unique to that person and the person that lived through those events and those times. And there's a lot of significance to that. So, again, I appreciate it very much. And with that, I'll stop the recording.
Okay.